Calanthe. "Know what?" Calanthe sat her down and explained, with Zona interposing her own observations and affirmations. The worst and most dreadful monsters, indeed the very kind that Apollo's oracle had predicted would devour her, possessed powers, always have done, were known for having, were celebrated the world over for having them. The power, for example, to transform themselves, to take on deceitful shapes, forms that might seem thrilling and attractive to the touch of a young girl, but this was only to win the trust of the innocent and foolish, so as one day to plant their demonic seed inside her. Poor girl, you don't understand these things, but men can do this and cause you to give birth to a new abomination, an even more terrible monster, a mutation. It's how they breed, how they propagate their vile species. Psyche held up a hand. Stop, please. I know you mean well, but you don't know how tender, how kind, how gentle. That's their way. That's exactly their way. Don't you see? If anything proves this monster's ferocious cruelty, it's this very tenderness and gentleness. A sure sign that it must be a hideous fiend. Psyche thought of the new life growing inside her, and of her husband's insistence that she tell no one of it, and of his refusal ever to show himself. Oh dear, perhaps her sisters were right. They saw that she was wavering, and they pounced. Here's what you do, my love. When he comes to you tonight, you allow him to have his beastly way with you, ugh, and then let him fall asleep. But you must stay awake. On all accounts, stay awake. When you're satisfied that he is absolutely fast asleep, you must rise and fetch a lamp and that razor that your handmaidens use to cut your hair. Yes, you'll need that. Light the lantern in the corner of the room and cover it so as not to wake him. Then steal over to the bed, lift your lantern, and slice his scaly dragon's neck. Saw away at his knotty veins. Kill him. Kill the beast. Then gather up all the gold and silver and the gemstones, that's most important. And on the sisters talked until Psyche was fully persuaded. And so, that night, it came about that with Eros sleeping peacefully in the bed, Psyche found herself standing over him, a hooded lantern in one hand and a razor in the other. She raised the blinds from the lamp. Light fell on the curled up, naked form of the most beautiful being she had ever beheld. The warm glow danced on smooth, youthful skin and on the most wonderful pair of feathered wings. Psyche could not hold back a gasp of amazement. She knew at once whom she was looking at. This was no dragon or monster, no ogre or abomination. This was the young god of love. This was Eros himself. To think that she could have dreamed of harming him. How beautiful he was. His full rosy lips were slightly parted, and the sweetness of his breath came up to her as she leaned down to gaze more deeply. Everything about him was so perfect. The gentle heave and swell of muscles gave his youthful beauty a manly cast, but without that hard, bulging ungainliness she had seen on the body of her father's champion athletes and warriors. His tousled hair gleamed with a warm colour that lay between the gold of Apollo and the mahogany of Hermes. And those wings! Folded beneath his body, they had the fullness and whiteness of a swan's. She reached out a trembling hand and ran her finger down the line of feathers. The soft, fluttering whisper they returned hardly made a sound, yet it was enough to cause the sleeping Eros to shift and murmur. Psyche pulled back and shaded the lantern, but within a few moments an even, rhythmic breathing reassured her that Eros was still deeply asleep. She unmasked the lantern again and saw that he was now turned away from her. She saw, too, that his movement had caused a curious object to be brought into view. The lamplight fell on a silver cylinder that lay beneath his wings. His quiver. Hardly daring to breathe, Psyche leant forward and pulled out a single arrow. Turning it in her hand, she slowly fingered its shaft of shining ebony. The arrowhead itself was affixed by a band of gold. Holding the lantern high in her left hand, she ran her right thumb along the head and then, ouch! So sharp was the tip that it drew blood. The moment it did, a feeling washed over her. A feeling of such intense love for the sleeping Eros, such heat, passion, and desire, such complete and eternal devotion that she could not refrain from moving to kiss the curls on the nape of his neck. Alas! As she did so, hot oil from the lantern dripped onto his right shoulder. He awoke with a yelp of pain, which, when he saw Psyche standing over him, grew into a great roar of disappointment and despair. His wings opened and began to beat the air. As he rose, Psyche launched herself forward and clung to his right leg, but his strength was too great, and he shook her off without a word and flew away into the night. The moment he left, everything fell apart. The walls of the palace rippled, faded, and dissolved into the night air. A despairing Psyche watched the gold columns around her shiver into a dark colonnade of trees, and the jeweled mosaic tiles beneath her feet churn into a mess of mud and gravel. Before long, palace, precious metals, precious stones, all had vanished. The sweet singing of the handmaidens turned into the howling of wolves and the screeching of owls, and the warm, mysterious perfumes whipped into chill and unrelenting winds. Alone. A frightened, unhappy girl stood in a cold and desolate wood. She slipped down the trunk of a tree until she sat on the hard roots. The only thought in her mind was to end her life. She was awoken by a beetle scuttling over her lips. She sat up with a shiver and unpeeled a damp leaf from her brow. She had not dreamed the horrors of the night before. She really was alone in a wood. Perhaps everything before was a dream, and this had always been the reality. Or she had awoken inside another episode of a wider dream. It was hardly worth the bother of trying to puzzle it all out. Dream or reality, everything was intolerable to her.
"Don't do it, pretty girl."
Shocked, Psyche looked up to see the god Pan standing before her. the humorous frown, the thick curling hair from which two horns sprouted, the wide hairy flanks tapering down to goat's feet, it could be no other figure mortal or immortal.
"No, no," said Pan, stamping the muddy ground with his hoofs. "I can read it in your face, and it is not to be. I won't allow it."
"You won't allow what?" said Psyche.
"I won't allow you to dash yourself onto the rocks from off a high cliff. I won't allow you to court the deadly attentions of a wild animal. I won't allow you to pick Belladonna and drink its poisonous juices. I won't allow any of that."
"But I can't live," cried Psyche. "If you knew my story, you would understand, and you would help me to die."
"You should ask yourself what brought you here," said Pan. "If it's love, then you must pray to Aphrodite and Eros for guidance and relief. If your own wickedness caused your downfall, then you must live to repent. If it was caused by others, then you must live to revenge."
Revenge. Psyche suddenly understood what needed to be done. She rose to her feet. "Thank you, Pan," she said. "You have shown me the way."
Pan bared his teeth in a grin and bowed. His lips blew a flourish of farewell across the top of his pipes. 4 days later, Psyche knocked on the gates of the grand mansion of her brother-in-law, the husband of Calanthe. A servant ushered her into her sister's receiving room.
"Psyche, darling, did all go as planned? You look a little..."
"Never mind me, dear sister. I followed your instructions to the letter, shone a lamp over the sleeping form of my husband, and who should he be but the great god Eros? Eros himself!"
"Eros!"
Calanthe clutched at her amber necklace. "Oh, sister, imagine my heartbreak and disappointment when he told me that he had only taken me to his palace as a means of securing you."
"Me?"
"That was his dark plan. 'Fetch me your beautiful sister Calanthe,' he said to me, 'she of the green eyes and russet hair.'"
"More auburn than russet."
"Fetch her. Tell her to go to the high rock. Launch herself on Zephyrus, who will pick her up and bring her to me. Tell the beautiful Calanthe all this, Psyche, I beg. This is his message, which I have faithfully relayed."
You can imagine with what speed Calanthe prepared herself. She left a scrawled message for her husband, explaining that they were not husband and wife after all, that their marriage had been a calamitous mistake, that the officiant who wed them had been drunk, incapable and unqualified, that she had never loved him anyway, and that she was now a free woman, so there. At the high basalt rock, she heard the rustle of a breeze, and with a moan of ecstatic joy launched herself onto what she thought was Zephyrus. But the spirit of the west wind was nowhere near. With a scream of frustration, rage, disappointment, and fear, Calanthe tumbled down the hillside, bouncing from sharp rock to sharp rock, until her whole body was turned inside out, and she landed at the bottom as dead as a stone. The identical fate befell her sister Zona, to whom Psyche told the same story. The Tasks of Aphrodite. With her revenge meted out, Psyche had the rest of her life to consider. Every waking moment was filled with the love and longing she felt for Eros, and with the pangs of misery that stabbed her, knowing she was doomed never to see him again. Eros, meanwhile, lay in a secret chamber, racked by the agony of the wound on his shoulder. You or I could endure with ease the slight nuisance of a lamp oil burn, but for Eros, immortal though he was, this was a hurt inflicted by the one he loved. Such wounds take a very long time to heal, if indeed they ever do. With Eros indisposed, the world began to suffer. Youths and maidens stopped falling in love. There were no marriages. The people began to murmur and grumble. Unhappy prayers were raised to Aphrodite. When she heard them and learned that Eros was hiding away and neglecting his duties, she became vexed. The news that a mortal girl had stolen her son's heart and caused him such harm turned her vexation to anger. But when she discovered that it was the very same mortal girl that she had once commanded Eros to humiliate, she grew livid. How could her plan to make Psyche fall in love with a pig have backfired so terribly? Well, this time she would personally and conclusively ensure the girl's downfall. Through enchantments that she did not know were being worked upon her, Psyche found herself knocking one day on a great palace door. Terrible creatures pulled her in by the hair and cast her into a dungeon. Aphrodite herself visited her, bringing sacks of wheat, barley, millet, poppy seed, chickpeas, lentils, and beans, which she emptied onto the stone floor and stirred together. "If you want your freedom," she said, "separate out all the different grains and seeds and sort them into their own heaps. Finish this task before next sunrise, and I will free you." With a laugh that, unbecomingly for a goddess of love and beauty, fell somewhere between a cackle and a screech, Aphrodite left, slamming the cell door behind her. Psyche fell sobbing to the floor. It would be impossible to separate those seeds, even if she had a month to do it. Just then, an ant, making its way across the flagstones, was engulfed by a hot, salt tear falling from Psyche's cheek. "Watch out!" he cried angrily. "It may be a little tear to you, but it's a deluge to me." "I'm so sorry," said Psyche. "I'm afraid I didn't see you. My misery got the better of me." "What misery can be so great that it causes you to go about half-drowning honest ants?" Psyche explained her plight, and the ant, who was of an obliging and forgiving nature, offered to help. With a cry inaudible to human ears, he summoned his great family of brothers and sisters, and together they set about sorting the seeds. With the tears drying on her cheeks, Psyche watched in amazement as 10,000 cheerful ants shuttled and scuttled back and forth, sifting and separating the seeds with military precision. Well before rosy-fingered Eos had cast open the gates of dawn, the job was done, and 7 neat and perfect piles awaited Aphrodite's inspection. The frustrated fury of the goddess was something to behold. Another impossible chore was instantly devised. "You see the grove yonder on the other side of the river?" said Aphrodite, yanking Psyche by the hair and forcing her to look out of the window. "There are sheep there, grazing and wandering unguarded, special sheep with fleeces of gold. Go there at once and bring me back a tuft of their wool." Psyche made her way out to the grove willingly enough, but with no intention of carrying out this second task. She resolved to use her freedom to escape not just the prison of Aphrodite's hateful curse, but the prison of hateful life itself. She would throw herself into the river and drown. But as she stood on the bank, breathing hard and summoning up the courage to dive in, one of the reeds nodded, although there wasn't a breath of breeze, and whispered to her,
"Psyche, sweet Psyche, harrowed by great trials as you are, do not pollute my clean waters with your death. There is a way through your troubles. The sheep here are wild and violent, guarded by the most ferocious ram whose horns could tear you open like a ripe fruit. You see them grazing there, under that plane tree on the farther bank? To approach them now would mean a swift and painful death, but if you lie down to sleep, by evening they will have moved to new pastures, and you will be able to swim across to the trees, where you will find tangles of golden wool clinging to its lower branches."
That night, an enraged and baffled Aphrodite cast the golden wool aside and insisted that Psyche descend to the underworld to beg a sample of beauty cream from Persephone. Since she had thought of little else but death, since Eros had left her, the poor girl consented willingly and followed Aphrodite's directions to Hades, where she fully intended to stay and see out a miserable, lonely, and loveless eternity. The Union of Love and Soul. One day, a garrulous swallow told Eros about the tasks which Psyche had been set by his jealous and intemperate mother. Trying to ignore the still agonizing pain of his wound, he rose up and with a mighty effort opened his wings. He flew straight to Olympus, where he demanded an immediate audience with Zeus. Eros told his story to an enraptured audience of fascinated Olympians. His mother had always hated Psyche. Aphrodite's dignity and honour as an Olympian had been threatened by the girl's beauty and the willingness of a handful of foolish humans to venerate the mortal maiden ahead of the immortal goddess. And so she had sent Eros to cause Psyche to fall in love with a pig. He put his case well. Zeus sent Hermes down to the underworld to fetch Psyche and an eagle to summon Aphrodite. When they were present before the heavenly company, Zeus spoke. "This has been an extraordinary and undignified entanglement. Aphrodite, beloved sister, your position is not threatened. It never can be. Look down at the earth and see how your name is everywhere sanctified and praised. Eros, you have too long been a foolish, impudent, and irresponsible boy. That you love and are loved will be the making of you, and may save the world from the worst excesses of your mischievous and misdirected arrows. Psyche, come and drink from my cup. This is ambrosia, and now that you have tasted it, you are immortal. Here, witnessed by us all, you will forever be yoked with Eros. Embrace your daughter-in-law, Aphrodite, and let us all be merry." All was laughter and delight at the wedding of Eros and Psyche. Apollo sang and played on his lyre. Pan joined in with his syrinx. Hera danced with Zeus, Aphrodite danced with Ares, and Eros danced with Psyche. And they dance together still, to this very day. In due time, Psyche gave birth to their child, a daughter, Hedone, who was to be the spirit of pleasure and sensual delight. The Romans called her Voluptas. Hedonism and voluptuousness are hers. Three. Mortals. Io. The humans of the Mediterranean world at this time were mostly ruled over by kings. How these autocrats established dominion over their peoples varied. Some were descended from immortals, gods even. Others, as is the human way, seized power through force of arms or political intrigue. Inachus was one of the very earliest rulers in Greece. He was the first king of Argos in the Peloponnese Peninsula, then a bustling new town, and now one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. Inachus was later semi-deified and turned into a river, but during his life as a human, his consort Melia bore him two daughters, Io and Mycenae, who gave her name to the city of Mycenae. Mycenae was satisfactorily married off to a nobleman called Arestor, but Io's fate was to be the first mortal girl to attract the predatory attentions of Zeus. Inachus had chosen Hera, the queen of heaven, as the patron deity of Argos, and his daughter Io had been brought up as a priestess in the most important shrine to Hera in all of Western Greece. For Zeus to dally with any female would be enough to cause his wife indignation, but any attempt to defile one of her own priestesses would stretch her anger to its limits. Yet he desired the lovely Io very much. How to have her without Hera finding out? Zeus stroked his beard, thought hard, and came up with what he believed was a masterstroke. He transformed Io into a cow, a beautiful, plump young heifer with shivering flanks and large, gentle eyes. A heifer is to a cow as a filly is to a mare. If he hid her in a field, Hera would never spot her, and he could visit her whenever he liked. Or so he imagined. When lust descends, discretion, common sense, and wisdom fly off, and what may seem cunning concealment to one in the grip of passion looks like transparently clumsy idiocy to everyone else. It is easier to hide 100 mountains from a jealous wife than one mistress. Hera noticed the cow and suspected its true identity straight away. "What a delightful heifer," Hera remarked casually to Zeus at breakfast on Olympus one morning. "Such a perfect shape, such long lashes and appealing eyes." "What, that old thing?" said Zeus, looking down with a feigned air of boredom to where Hera was pointing. "That's one of your fields, darling, so she must be one of yours." "Possibly," said Zeus, "very possibly. One has thousands of cows browsing around. Can't be expected to keep tabs on all of them." "I should very much like that particular heifer," said Hera, "as a birthday present." Really? That one? Oh, I'm sure I could find you a much fatter and fitter animal." "No," said Hera, and those who knew her would have recognized the glint in her eye and the steel in her voice. "That is the one I should like."
"Certainly, certainly," said Zeus, affecting a yawn. "She's yours. There's a jar of ambrosia at your elbow. Chuck it down my end, would you?"
Hera knew her husband all too well. Once his libidinous propensities were aroused, there would be no taming them. She had Io moved to a small gated paddock and sent her servant Argus, Inachus's grandson, to watch over her. Argus, son of Mycenae and Arestor, was a loyal follower of Hera's, like all the Argives at that time. Argive meant citizen of Argos, but in later times was often used to mean any Greek, especially as distinct from a Trojan. But Argus also possessed a very special gift which made him a perfect guardian of his Aunt Io. He had 100 eyes. His nickname was Panoptes, the all-seeing. There are those who like to suggest that the idea of Argus having 100 eyes arose from a fanciful way of expressing his extreme watchfulness. It might just as well have been playfully said, and then seriously believed, they maintain, that he had eyes in the back of his head. We repudiate such dull, unromantic propositions with the contempt they deserve. Argus had 100 eyes. Fact. Obedient as ever to Hera's will, he stationed himself in the field, fixed 50 eyes on Io, and let the other 50 range independently around and up and down on the lookout for marauders. Zeus saw this and paced about in a fury. His blood was up. He crashed his fist into his palm. He would have Io. It had become a matter of principle to defeat Hera in this silent and unacknowledged war. He knew the limits of his own cunning, however, so he called upon the wiliest and most amoral rogue on Olympus to aid him. Hermes understood right away what needed to be done. Ever happy to oblige Zeus and sow mischief, he hurried to Io's paddock. "Hello, Argus. Let me keep you company for a while," he said, unlatching the gate and slipping in. "Nice heifer you've got there." Argus swiveled a dozen eyes towards Hermes, who sat down on the grass, took out a set of pipes, and started to play. For 2 hours he played and he sang. The music, the afternoon heat, the scent of poppies, lavender and wild thyme, the soft lapping and purling of a nearby stream. Slowly, Argus's eyes started to close, one by one. As the very 100th eye at last winked shut, Hermes lowered his pipes, stole forward, and stabbed Argus in the heart. All the gods were capable of great cruelty. Hermes could be as vicious as any of them. With Argus dead, Zeus opened the gate into the field and set Io free. But before he had a chance to change her back into human form, Hera, who had seen what had happened, sent down a gadfly, which stung Io so painfully and persistently that she bucked and screamed and galloped away far from Zeus's reach. Sorrowing at the death of her beloved servant, Hera took Argus's 100 bright eyes and fixed them onto the tail of a very dull, dowdy old fowl, transforming it into what we know today as the peacock, which is how the now proud, colourful and haughty bird came forever to be associated with the goddess. Painters and sculptors often depicted Hera on a chariot drawn by peacocks, and there is, of course, the Sean O'Casey play, Juno and the Peacock. Io, meanwhile, charged on along the northern shore of the Aegean Sea, swimming over at the place where Europe becomes Asia, the spot we still call in her honour the Cow Crossing, or in Greek, the Bosphorus. Strange that Oxford and Bosphorus mean exactly the same thing. On and on she careered, thrashing, tossing, and squealing in her agony until she reached the Caucasus. There, the gadfly seemed to relent for a while, enough for her to see the figure of Prometheus, racked in pain upon the mountainside. "Sit down and catch your breath a while, Io," said the Titan. "Be of good cheer. Things will get better." "They could hardly be worse," wailed Io. "I'm a cow. I'm being attacked by the largest and most spiteful gadfly the world has ever seen.
Hera will destroy me. It's only a question of whether I am stung to death or go mad and drown myself in the sea.
I know it seems dark for you now, said Prometheus, but I see into the future sometimes, and I do know this. You will return to human shape. You will found a great dynasty in the land where Nilus crawls, and from your line will spring the greatest of all the heroes. So, chin up and be cheerful, eh? The very hero, in fact, who would one day unchain Prometheus and set him free.
It was hard for Io, in all her tribulation, to ignore these words from one who, even as she looked on in horror, was being ripped open and gorged upon by a pair of evil-looking vultures. What were her minor inconveniences when set against his perpetual agony? As things turned out, Io did return to human shape. She met up with Zeus in Egypt and bore him a son, Epaphus, who will play an important part of the story of Phaeton, which is just coming up. Supposedly, Zeus impregnated Io just by gently laying a hand on her. Epaphus means touch. She had a daughter by Zeus too, Charissa, whose son Bizas went on to found Byzantium. Whether Charissa was conceived by touch or the more traditional method of generation, we do not know. Io may have been a cow, but she was a very influential and important one.
The Semen-Soaked Scarf. A rather touching story tells of how Athena had a role in the conception and birth of one of the founders of the city-state of Athens without sacrificing her chastity. Lame Hephaestus, ever since splitting Zeus's head and thereby helping bring her into the world, had developed a strong passion for Athena. One day, unable to control his lust, he tracked her down to some corner of High Olympus and tried to force himself on her. Alas, in his excitement, he succeeded only in spilling his seed on her thigh. Athena, in silent disgust, removed her headband and used it to wipe up the mess before throwing it down the mountain. The sodden fillet landed on the ground far below. Hephaestus's divine semen seeped into the earth, and Gaia was made pregnant. From her was born a boy, Erechtheus. The name Erechthonius is sometimes used of both Erechtheus and his various descendants. His chthonic birth out of Gaia can be seen in both names. Looking down from heaven, Athena saw this and determined that this child should be immortal. She descended from Olympus, put the baby in a wicker basket, closed it up, and placed it in the care of three sisters, Herse, Aglaros, and Pandrosos. On no account, Athena told them, must the basket ever be opened. But Aglaros and Herse could not resist peeping inside. They saw a wriggling baby boy bound up in the coils of a writhing snake. All snakes were sacred to Athena, and this one was a part of the enchantment which the goddess was using to endow the infant Erechtheus with immortality. The shocking sight sent the two women instantly insane, and they threw themselves off the topmost point of the hill, now called the Acropolis, or High Citadel. Erechtheus grew up to be, or to father, the stories disagree, Erechthonius, the legendary founder of Athens. If you visit the Acropolis today, you can still see, just to the north of the Parthenon, the beautiful temple called the Erechtheum. Its famous porch of caryatid columns, in the form of draped maidens,
is one of the great architectural treasures of the world. Shrines were erected not far away to poor Aglaros and Herse too, which is only fitting. I've not been able to discover what happened to Pandrosos, the obedient sister who resisted looking into the basket. She does not seem to be celebrated in song or in stone. Virtue is its own punishment. Phaeton. The Son of the Sun. Erechtheus had Athena as a proxy parent, Gaia as a mother, and Hephaestus as a father. Three immortal parents could be regarded as overdoing it and boasting on the part of the Athenians, but it was not uncommon for mortals to claim one. The story of the brave but foolhardy Phaeton, like that of Persephone, explains how certain changes to the geography of the world came about, as well as offering a very literal example of a favourite finger-wagging lesson of Greek myth, how pride comes before a fall. Phaeton, like Apollo's alternative name Phoebus, means shining one, sometimes rendered as Phaethon, Phaeton, or Phathon. It's usually pronounced to rhyme with Satan or Nathan, though you can, if you prefer, rhyme it with Titan or Python as Phaeton. Phaeton had divine parentage, but was brought up by his stepfather, Merops, a disappointingly mortal man. Whenever Merops was away, Phaeton's mother, Clymene, who may or may not have been immortal, would delight the boy with stories of his divine father, the glorious sun god, Phoebus Apollo. A daughter of Oceanus and Tethys, the Oceanid Clymene might be regarded as one of the most influential mothers in all Greek myth. From her couplings with the Titan Iapetus, she was on the one side the mother of Atlas and Menoetius, two Titans who furiously opposed the gods over the long course of the Titanomachy and were duly punished, and on the other of Epimetheus and Prometheus. These offspring alone established Clymene's importance as a great matriarch of the early world. Some say that the Oceanid Clymene and the Clymene who was Phaeton's mother were not the same woman at all, and that actually the mother of Atlas and the other Titans should be called Asia, so as not to muddle her with the mortal Clymene, mother of Phaeton. It all gets very confusing and is best left to academics and those with time on their hands. Even the nature of Phaeton's father is debated. In some versions of the story, his father is the Titan of the Sun, Helios. I shall go along with Ovid and attribute the fatherhood of Phaeton to the god Apollo. When Phaeton was old enough, he went to school alongside other mortal boys, some of whom were fully human, and others of whom, like him, could claim divine ancestry on one side or another. One such was Epaphus, the son of Zeus and Io. With such illustrious parents, Epaphus felt entitled to lord it over his schoolmates. Phaeton, who was a proud and passionate youth, hated being bossed around by Epaphus and was constantly irritated by the other's arrogance and air of superiority. He was always so maddeningly blasé about his pedigree. Epaphus would say things like, "Yes, this weekend, Dad, Zeus, don't you know, is inviting me up to Olympus for supper. He said he might let me sit on his throne, maybe take a sip or two of nectar. Had it before, of course. There'll just be a few of us, Uncle Ares, my half-sister Athena, a few nymphs, perhaps, to round up the numbers. Should be a laugh." Phaeton would come home in a fury after enduring this oh-so-casual name-dropping. "How come," he would complain to his mother, "Epaphus gets to see his father every weekend when I have never even met mine?" Clymene would hug her son tightly and try to explain.
Apollo is so busy, darling. Every day he has to drive his chariot of the sun across the sky. And when that duty is done, he has shrines at Delos and Delphi and goodness knows where else to attend. Prophecies, music, archery. He is quite the busiest of all the gods. But I'm sure he'll come and visit us soon. When you were born, he left this for you. I was going to wait to give it to you when you were a little older, but you might as well have it now.
Clymene went to a cupboard and took out an exquisite golden flute, which she handed to him. The boy at once brought it to his mouth and blew, producing a breathy and far from musical hiss.
What is it supposed to do?
Do? What do you mean, darling?
Zeus gave Epaphus a magic leather whip which makes dogs obey his every command. What does this do?
It's a flute, my love. It makes music. Beautiful, charming music.
How?
Well, you learn how to shape the notes and then you... well, you play it.
Where's the magic in that?
Have you never heard flute music?
It's the most magical sound there is.
It does take rather a lot of practice, though.
Phaeton threw the instrument down in disgust and stormed off to his bedroom, where he sulked for the rest of the day and night. A week or so later, on the last day of term before the long summer holidays, he found himself being approached by the exasperatingly condescending Epaphus.
"Hi there, Phaeton," he drawled. "Wondered if you wanted to join me at the family villa on the North African coast next week. Small enough house party, just Dad, maybe Hermes, Demeter and a few fauns. We sail tomorrow. Could be a laugh. What do you say?"
"Oh, what a shame!" cried Phaeton. "My father, Phoebus Apollo, you know, has invited me to drive the sun chariot across the sky next week. Can't let him down."
"Excuse me?"
"Yes, didn't I mention it? He's always going on at me to help take the load off his shoulders, do a bit of the old sun driving for him."
"You're seriously telling me? Bullshit.
Guys, you got to come and listen to this."
Epaphus called the other boys over to where he and Phaeton stood facing each other.
"Tell them," he demanded.
Phaeton was caught in the lie now. Pride, fury, and frustration drove him on. He was damned if he was going to back down and let this insufferable snob win the day.
"It's really nothing," he said, "just that my dad, Apollo, is insisting I learn to drive the horses of the sun. No big deal."
The other boys, led by a sneering Epaphus, hooted their disbelief and derision.
"We all know your father is that boring old fool Merops," one of them shouted. "He's just my stepfather," cried Phaeton. "Apollo is my real father. He is. You'll see. Just you wait and see. It'll take me a while to get to his palace, but one day soon, look up at the sky. I'll wave down at you. That'll be me driving the day along. You'll see."
And off he ran home. Jeers, catcalls, and the mocking laughter of his schoolfellows ringing in his ears. One of the boys, his friend and lover, Cygnus, chased after him.
"Oh, Phaeton," cried Cygnus, "what have you said? It can't be true. You've complained to me so many times that you've never even met your real father. Go back and tell them you were joking."
"Leave me alone, Cygnus," said Phaeton, pushing him away. "I'm going to the Palace of the Sun. It's the only way to silence that pig Epaphus. By the time you see me again, everyone will respect me at last and know me for who I really am."
"But I know who you are," said the unhappy Cygnus. "You are Phaeton, and I love you."
Father and Son. Nor was there anything Clymene could say to make Phaeton change his mind. She watched in an agony of distress as he gathered up his few belongings.
"Look up, and you'll see me," he said, kissing her farewell. "I'll wave as I ride by."
The Palace of the Sun lay, of course, due east, in fact, as far east as India. How Phaeton got there isn't agreed upon. I have read that magical sun hawks told Apollo of the boy's slow struggle from mainland Greece across Mesopotamia and Persia, and that the god instructed these splendid birds to bear him up and fly him the rest of the way. However Phaeton got there, he arrived at night, and immediately was summoned to the throne room of the palace, where Apollo sat, robed in purple, in the glimmer that gleamed from the gold, silver, and jewels which decorated the chamber. The throne he sat in, that alone, was studded with more than 10,000 rubies and emeralds. The youth fell to his knees, quite overpowered by the magnificence of the palace, the dazzle of the gemstones, and above all, by the radiant glory of his father, the god. "So, you are Clymenes, boy, are you? Stand up, let's have a look at you. Yes, I can see that you might be the fruit of my loins. You have the cast of countenance, the colouring. I'm told you travelled the long way to be here. Why?" The question was blunt, and Phaeton found himself a little flustered. He managed to stammer out some words about Epaphus and the other boys, and was painfully aware that he sounded more like a spoiled child than the proud son of an Olympian. "Yes, yes, very mean, very disrespectful. And where do I come in?" "All my life," said Phaeton, burning with the pride and resentment that had smouldered inside him for so very long. "All my life, my mother has told me about great and glorious Apollo, the golden god, my shining, perfect father. But you've never visited us. You've never invited us anywhere. You've never even acknowledged me." "Well, yes, I'm sorry about that. Remiss of me. I've been a terrible father. I wish I could make it up to you." Apollo mouthed the words that absent fathers mouth everywhere and every day, but his mind was really on horses, music, drink, anything but this tedious, sulky, and complaining child. "If you could just grant me one wish, that's all." Of course, name it." "Really? You mean it?" "Of course." "You swear you'll grant it?" "I swear," said Apollo, amused by the boy's extreme earnestness. "I swear by my lyre. I swear by the cold flowing waters of the Styx herself. Name it, I say." "I want to drive your horses." "My horses?" said Apollo, not quite understanding. "Drive them? What do you mean?" "I want to steer the sun chariot across the sky, tomorrow." "Oh, no," said Apollo, a smile spreading across his face. "No, no, no. Don't be silly. No one can do that." "You promised, Phaeton, Phaeton. It's brave and splendid even to dream of doing such a thing. But no one, no one drives those animals but me." "You swore by the Styx. Zeus himself couldn't control them. They are the strongest, wildest, most headstrong and unmanageable stallions ever born. They answer to my touch and mine alone. No, no, you can't ask such a thing." "I have asked it, and you have sworn." "Phaeton!" The other 11 gods would have been astonished to hear such a pleading, desperate note in Apollo's voice. "I beg of you! Anything else, gold, food, power, knowledge, love, you name it, it's yours in perpetuity, but not this. Never this. I have asked and you have sworn," the stubborn youth replied. Apollo bowed his golden head and cursed
inwardly. Oh, those gods and their quick tongues! Oh, those mortals and their foolish dreams! Will either ever learn?
Right, let's go and meet them then, but know this, Apollo said as they neared the stables and the horsey smell grew stronger and sharper in Phaeton's nostrils. You can change your mind at any time. I won't think any the less of you, frankly. I'll think a great deal the more of you. At their approach, the four stallions, white with golden manes, stamped and shifted in their stalls. Hey, Parois! Whoa there, Phlegon! Hush now, Eos! Quietly, Aethon! Apollo called to each in turn. All right, come forward, boy. Let them get to know you. Phaeton had never seen such beautiful horses. Their eyes flashed gold, and their hoofs struck sparks on the flagstones. He was filled with awe, but felt too a sudden stab of fear, which he tried to play off as thrilled anticipation. Lined up before the massive gates of dawn was a golden quadriga, the great chariot to which the four stallions would soon be harnessed. A quiet female figure in saffron robes hurried past. Phaeton caught from her a fragrance which he could not name but which made him dizzy with delight. That was Eos, said Apollo. It will soon be time for her to open the gates. Phaeton knew all about Eos, the goddess of the dawn. She was known as Rhododactylos, the rosy-fingered one, admired everywhere for her sweetness and soft beauty. As he helped his father walk the stallions forward and into position at the head of the chariot, Phaeton suddenly felt himself pushed roughly aside. What is this mortal doing? A huge figure, dressed in shining buff leather armour, had taken the bridle of all four horses at once and was leading them forward. Helios, there you are, said Apollo. This is Phaeton, my son, Phaeton.
So?
Phaeton knew that Helios was the brother of Eos and the moon goddess Selene, and assisted Apollo in his daily duties with the chariot. Apollo seemed slightly awkward in the Titan's presence.
Well, the thing is, Phaeton will be driving the chariot today.
Excuse me?
Well, he might as well learn now, don't you think?
You are joking.
I sort of promised.
Well, sort of unpromised, then.
Helios, I can't. You know I can't.
Helios stamped his foot and gave a roar that caused the horses to rear and whinny.
You've never once let me drive, Apollo. Never. How many times have I asked and how many times have you told me I'm not ready? And now you let this shrimp take the reins?
Helios, you will do as you're told, said Apollo. I have spoken, and so I have spoken.
Apollo took the four leather traces from Helios and lifted Phaeton up and onto the seat of the chariot. Helios gave a shout of laughter as he saw the youth slide back and forth.
He rolls in it like a little pea,
he said with a surprisingly high-pitched giggle. He'll be fine. Now, Phaeton, these reins, they are your lines of communication with the horses. They know the way. They run this course every day, but you must show them that you are their master. You understand? Phaeton nodded eagerly. Something of his nervous excitement and Helios's fury seemed to have been picked up by the horses, who bucked and snorted restlessly. The most important thing, continued Apollo, is to fly neither too high nor too low, a middle course between the sky and the earth.
Yes?
Again, Phaeton nodded. Oh, I nearly forgot. Hold out your hands. Apollo took a jar and poured oil from it into Phaeton's outstretched palms.
Anoint yourself in that all over. It will protect you from the heat and light generated by the stallions as they gallop through the air. The earth below will be warmed and lit as you go, so keep a straight line westward towards the Garden of the Hesperides. It's a 12-hour drive. Be steady. Remember, the horses know. Call them by name, Eos and Ethon up front, Pyrois and Phlegon behind. As Apollo said their names, Phaeton saw their ears prick up.
But it's not too late, boy.
You've seen them, you've handled them. I'll give you gold sculptures of them cast by Hephaestus to take home. That should satisfy your school friends. Another high-pitched titter from Helios sent a flush to Phaeton's cheek. No, he said stiffly. You gave a promise, and so did I.
Daybreak. As Phaeton spoke, Eos came forward in a bright cloud of pearl and rose. She bowed smilingly to Apollo and Helios, looked a puzzled question at the blushing Phaeton in the chariot, and took up her position at the gates of dawn. To a traveller, looking eastwards and upwards at the clouds in which the palace of the sun was hidden, the first sign that Eos was at work always came in the form of a flush of coral pink that suffused the sky. As she threw the gates wider, that soft pink hardened into a gleam of gold that grew ever brighter and fiercer. To Phaeton inside, the effect was reversed. The doors opened to reveal the dark world beyond, illumined only by the silver gleam from Eos and Helios's sister, the moon goddess Selene, reaching the end of her nightly course. As Eos pushed the gates further open, Phaeton saw pink and gold light radiate outwards, drowning the darkness of the night. As if that were a signal, the four horses pricked their ears, shuddered, and reared. Phaeton was jerked back in his seat, and the chariot beneath him began to roll forward.
"Remember, boy," shouted Apollo, "don't panic. A firm hand. Don't snatch at the reins. Just let the horses know you're in control. Everything will be fine."
"After all,"
cried Helios, as the chariot began to lift from the ground.
"What can possibly go wrong?"
His squeals of falsetto laughter stung Phaeton like a lash. Switching points of view again to the traveller looking eastwards from the road below, the gold gleam is now a great ball of fire that is becoming harder and harder to observe without squinting. The short flush of dawn is over, and the day has begun.
The drive.
Apollo's horses charged upwards, pawing the air. All was well. They knew what they were doing. They reached a certain height, leveled out, and charged forwards. This was easy. Phaeton pulled himself upright, careful not to strain the traces, and looked around. He could see the curve that marked the separation of blue sky and star-filled darkness. He could see the effect of the light blazing out from the chariot. He was insulated, somehow magically safe from its heat and its glare, but great clouds melted and fizzed into vapour as they approached. He looked down and saw the long shadows of mountains and trees contract as they flew forwards. He saw the wrinkled sea send back a million scintillations of light, and he saw the sparkle of dew rising into a shimmering mist as they neared the coast of Africa. Somewhere, just west of Nilus, Epiphus would be holidaying on the beach. Oh, this was going to be the greatest triumph ever.
As the coastline swung more clearly into view, Phaeton pulled at the reins, trying to nose down Eos, the lead horse on his left-hand side. Eos had perhaps been thinking of other things, of golden straw or pretty mares. He had certainly not been imagining a tug to pull him off course. In a panic, he shied and dived, pulling the other horses with him. The chariot bucked in the air and plummeted straight for the earth. In vain, Phaeton tugged the reins, which had somehow become tangled in his hands. The green earth screamed towards him, and he saw his certain death. He took one final desperate yank at the reins, and at the very last minute, either in response to that pull or as an instinctive move to save themselves, the four steeds swooped upwards and galloped blindly north. But not before Phaeton saw with terror and dismay that the terrible heat of the sun chariot had set the earth on fire. As they flew on, a raging curtain of flame swept across the land below, burning everything and everyone upon it to a crisp. The whole strip of Africa below the northern coast was laid waste. To this day, most of the land is a great parched desert, which we call the Sahara, but which to the Greeks was the land that Phaeton scorched. He was now terribly out of control. The horses knew for certain that the familiar firm hand of Apollo was not there to guide them.